Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Welcome, everybody. Jared got his dates muddled up, so Jared's in Hobart, and so I'm here. It's our discussion on the budget, which for the Sydney Institute, we're taking a new approach. Only people under 35, am I right, are allowed to give the speeches tonight, except for me introducing them. We've got Shari Markson and BuzzFeed's Mark DeStefano. Sorry, everything's gone wrong tonight. You have no doubt seen them or watched their work, whatever. I haven't brought my notes with me, but this is the political editor of BuzzFeed, which is described as a viral news outlet or something.
Something like that.
You know, in my generation, if it was viral, you needed a doctor. But today, it seems like it's the face of the future. And Sherry, you're the national editor of the Daily Telegraph?
National political editor of the Daily Telegraph.
And Sherry has quite a past. She's done undercover reporting in London. Don't go there. She was Clio's editor for a year and she took sex off the cover. So these are the future here. I'm the past. And we're going to hear from Mark first. Now, I'm sorry about the setup. We've got no microphone, so you have to shout, guys. And we have a slide projector onto this wall, which some of you people down there will find a bit hard to see. But we are still in our learning curve days. So welcome, Mark DeStefano, on the budget 2017.
Yeah, a couple of journos. I don't think we're going to be any struggling for voice. Sherry and I do like talking, so I don't think it's going to be a problem. Thank you, Anne, so much for the invitation. For those who don't know me, my name's Mark DeStefano. I'm the political editor at BuzzFeed here in Australia. And my reporting chops are that I was an ABC reporter for 5 years. So I do have a background in reporting that a lot of people in this room would know, but I made the jump to go to BuzzFeed, which a lot of people blanch at, because I think it's just the name sounds funny, BuzzFeed. And we do we did start as a website that was quite well known for cats and viral content, but now we are moving into sort of straight reporting and real news. So it's an honour, and it's a bit weird to be talking at the Sydney Institute. I sort of having this behind me, and there'll be a photo later on. It's a bit crazy because 3 years ago I was a TV reporter up at the ABC in Darwin. And I was chuckling every week because I would always read this interesting email I got every Friday written from the perspective of a dog. And it was Jared and Anne's dog. And now I'm up here. So life comes at you fast. I thought I'd talk about what I know the most and sort of talk to an audience that might not get this perspective all the time, which is the internet. So it should not be breaking news to anyone here that more and more Australians are primarily focusing their news and getting their news from this device, the phone. To find the latest news from trusted journalists like Shari and mastheads, we open Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or Apple News. We can argue about whether Facebook and aggregators like Google and Apple are good for journalism. That's a topic for another night, and I would need a couple more drinks before we actually go into that. But with collapsing newspaper sales and flat TV figures, those in the media know that the mass audience, as in the biggest audience, right now is on the internet. The latest data suggests, and sometimes it just baffles me, but this is true, 15 million Australians use Facebook every single month. That's 12 million Australians every day that use Facebook, open up Facebook. It's an astronomical number for a population of 24 million. They're not just communicating with each other in the comments of Dashdown videos, like me and my fiancé do. Millions are gobbling up and sharing news and links. I wanted to answer the question for this Sydney Institute tonight. What were the most widely shared stories about the budget? And what can that tell us about the government and how they sold the budget? What was in the budget? And perhaps, what does it say about the media today? So to that, I spent yesterday pulling the 100 most shared federal political news stories. The time frame was the week before the budget, the week during the budget, and the week after. I used a social media monitoring tool called BuzzSumo. Now, it's probably going to freak out a lot of people, I promise you. I know it sounds like BuzzFeed, it's got nothing to do with us. But what it is like a dashboard where it shows you how often a story has been shared on Facebook or Twitter or LinkedIn or Pinterest. Now, if that's all gobbledygook, I'm really sorry. It might terrify you to know that these tools like BuzzSumo are used in most newsrooms these days, and they allow us as journalists to track what stories are really moving and what were the ones that people are talking about. So, to that end, this is the most shared story in the last 3 weeks in Australia. See if we get Jackie Lambie welcomes welfare drug tests, calls for same regime for politicians. It was published on ABC News the day after the budget. It was shared on the internet 33,800 times. Now, that's a lot, and that's not seen by 33,800 people. It is 33,800 people around the entire country that put it on their Facebook feed or their Twitter timeline and shared it with hundreds or thousands or tens of thousands more people. That's one single story. In my 3 years working at BuzzFeed, trust me, for an Australian political story, that's a lot. And now I want to show you the top 10 of the last 3 weeks, the most shared federal political stories. Now, I know there's this end of the room, so I'm going to read some out to you. So obviously at the top, there's Jackie Lambie. The second one is a New York Times report about the NBN. That was shared 21,000 times. Then we've got a bunch of stories about Larissa Waters, the Green Senator, breastfeeding in Parliament. There's three of those on the top 10 list. But then you've also got things like the AMA calling for same-sex marriage. You've got Federal Labor back down on the Adani coal mine. And you've got universities, which is a story by Fairfax, and that was shared about 12,000 times. But what I wanted to do is I wanted to show the next 10, because all of these are now clumped together. And what you've got is you've got a welfare story, drug testing story, drug testing story, drug testing story, welfare story, Trump talk story, Larissa Waters, Penny Wong, drug testing story, and a story about politicians' expenses. And these are shared more than 10,000 times each. And again, it's just a single story. We're not talking about the actual genre of story, it's a single story. There's a lot we can pass through on this data, but especially the top 100, which is a spreadsheet I'm going to post online later. And I don't even want to make this one of the points, but I'll make it anyway. The Larissa Waters story was absurdly popular, and men in this room might not know this, but there's this thing called Mum Facebook, and it's terrifying. One of the reasons why the Larissa Waters story is shared so well is that other women are sharing it. They don't even know who she is, but they love the image of her breastfeeding in Parliament. So here's my first proper point. The drug testing for welfare trial that was announced by the government is easily the most widely shared story from federal politics in the last 3 weeks. And the pie chart, you might not be able to pass through the colours, but what I wanted to say is this. 15 of the top 100 stories were reports or commentary from different media outlets about the drug testing trial. That's 15% of the entire 100. It's not just that. If you add up all these stories, the story was shared around 130,000 times. That's 20% of the entire share total. Now, one thing I will say about this, and this is probably something that a few of the news corpers in this room will say, it does help news outlets like the ABC News, like Fairfax, that are open and free that don't have paywalls. If you do have a paywall on your website, like The Australian does, like The Daily Telegraph, like The Herald Sun, it means that you don't really show up in these titles as much as you could. If you're a member of Social Services Minister Christian Porter's office, the very best thing that happened in the budget was when Jackie Lambie was on a stool on Sunrise telling Koshy that she wanted to see politicians tested for drugs. My second point, and this is a bit of an extension on the first, the drug testing for welfare trial is very popular. We reported on a YouGov poll of 1,000 people last week. It found 2/3 supported the idea of drug testing welfare recipients. This is a victory for the government. the one budget item that was truly mainstreamed, that was the water cooler story of the last 3 weeks, has wide popular support. My third point, the welfare crackdown was everywhere. In the months leading up to the budget, Porter and Human Services Minister Alan Tudge have been leaving breadcrumbs that bit by bit amount to a widely shared welfare crackdown narrative. If you remember, 15 of the top 100 were about drug testing. Another 11 are about other welfare measures, like when Shari reported about on the eve of the budget a demerit system and restrictions on single-person payments. Almost a quarter of the shared, most shared stories in the last 3 weeks were about welfare. Let that sink in. That is what people in the mainstream are receiving out of this budget. The fourth point, people actually paid attention to policy when it was there. The government's big announcements this year were about university cuts, Gonski funding, and changes to healthcare, and they led to very popular news cycles for the government. On universities and Gonski, the government owned their cycles a week out from the budget. But think about this. Probably the biggest story in the wake of the budget is the banking tax. It's what everyone's talking about, just in terms of column inches, if you turn on the TV at the moment. It's all been stoked by party divisions as well. It's a proxy war for the leadership as well. Note, not one story about the banking tax makes the top 100 most shared stories from the last 3 weeks. Fifth point, Labor was nowhere. Now, these are two stories that did appear from the Labor perspective. Despite getting their own budget reply, they had five of the top 100 most shared stories, just 5%. If you cast your mind back 2 weeks, you'll remember Bill Shorten had a really bad day on the eve of the budget. He released that racist Australian's first ad cartoon, TV advertising. Our BuzzFeed report on the ad made that list, as did a couple of other stories about Labor, but not very many. My sixth point, ABC News Online is free, and it's a dominant news service at the moment. This is a pie chart that I made about where the stories are coming from of the top 100. I thought there's no point in coming to Jared and Anne's house unless you're going to take a jab at Auntie.
I'll send you a text.
Yeah, please. Last week, Fairfax's Greg Highwood had a whinge to the Senate's journalism inquiry about the ABC News undermining commercial news services. I assume this is what he's actually talking about. Remember, Fairfax was on a strike for a week during this entire period. News Corp is scattered in this pie graph and in some cases paywalled. ABC News has become a very trusted source for political news for people around the country, and people are sharing their stories big time. That's what gets people like Greg Highwood very upset. Seventh point. Fake news is not a thing. If you follow me on Twitter, which I probably not everyone in this room would, you'll know that I've been banging on this for a while. Unlike the US or in European countries at the moment, Australia does not have or suffer from this problem of manufactured news that is acting as propaganda, like we saw during the US election last year. There are only mainstream media outlets on this list. So I'll just end by saying this. I think it's always important to look at the stories that have had real cut through, the water cooler stories, the ones relatives not in the echo chamber come up to you at barbecues and say, did you see that? And the ones that don't always talk about politics to you. For a long time, journalists and editors have relied upon experience and gut feel. I'm not suggesting that we shouldn't keep going with that. Experience and gut feel are really important. But now we have a lot of data to look at what our constituents, our readers, are actually talking about. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you, Mark. And here comes Shari. Shari Markson. Yes.
I don't know if my voice is going to be loud enough without a microphone. How does that... Is that all... Can everyone hear me?
Yeah.
I just thought before I'd start, I'd do a small rebuttal to Mark, just a small one, on the fact that I think the reason the ABC topped that list of the most shared stories wasn't because it's the most trusted, but because, as you say, it's free. Whereas, you know, quality investigative journalism and exclusives at the Daily Telly and even at the Herald, which also doesn't have the same paywall that we have, you know, you have to pay for the news. So the ABC is playing in the commercial space, and I think that was Greg Hywood's argument, although I'm not one to often defend Greg Hywood. So among my family and friends, I'm famously terrible at managing my own household budget, and I often only realise or think to check the postbox for an electricity bill when my lights have gone out. So it's kind of unusual for me to be standing here this evening analysing the federal budget as a national political editor at the Daily Telegraph. But still, I guess Paul Keating was late filing his tax returns twice, and it could be worse, you could be Michael Cranston. Truly, I'm delighted to be here this evening to talk about one of the things I love most in this world, federal politics. I first started reporting in the Canberra Press Gallery a decade ago, at the end of the Howard era, which was probably our last period of political stability in recent history. Since then, I've held several roles, but was always drawn back to the pull of federal politics, even while editing Clio magazine, which had more of a gender politics approach than a Canberra politics approach. I'd leave the glossy world of fashion from time to time to catch up with a federal MP at a pub in the city. And the federal budget may seem dry to most people, although we did have quite a lot of fun with it at the Daily Telly. I don't know if you saw our front page. We dressed up the treasurer in a white suit, no shoes, and had him amongst a setting of fairies and unicorns. Maybe his dream world, hoping for a happier place and better days. But for those of us who work in the gallery, the day federal budget is handed down is the single most thrilling day of the year, truly. And when you sit down in the budget lockup and you pull out the hefty pile of budget books from the bag, and you kind of desperately, breathlessly turn to table one, book one, to find out the size of the surplus and the depth of the deficit, as Adam Crichton over there knows, it truly is exciting. Right now, the budget is still being sold. The reaction is being gauged by Australians. If you asked probably Scott Morrison to describe this year's federal budget, he'd say it was a pragmatic one. Turnbull would probably say it was the budget he had to have. Credlin would call it Labor light. And if you ask the banks, they'd say it was... I can't say that quite in public, and definitely not on live television. The budget has been characterised as Labor. The situation is far more complex than that, but it is true that the path the government has taken to return the budget to balance is through raising taxes, not cutting them, and there's no getting away from that. It's understandable why Morrison and Turnbull went down that path. Political chaos and stalemates in the Senate meant that the government, elected with a mandate, had been unable to implement its agenda. Like Abbott before him, Turnbull won the election. But this doesn't matter so much in politics these days. What most of you in the room know, because most of you are over 35, is that this is relatively new to Australian politics, that budgets aren't passed, of course with the exception of the 75 dismissal and a couple of others in the 90s. But Turnbull's reform agenda had been blocked and diluted at every path, held hostage either by Labor, the crossbench, or detractors in his own party. Federal politicians were accused of living in a bubble, seemingly unaware of how this infighting and squabbling was alienating voters. There is no way Turnbull could have lasted or afforded another year of this cycle. Even Abbott recognised that and said as much on radio last week. Turnbull was struggling for authority, not only in his party, but in the parliament. He needed to reset the agenda, seize control with a budget that could win the support of the Senate, that could actually have a chance of passing. But the question Liberal ministers and voters have been left with is this: what does the Liberal Party stand for under Turnbull? What are its central tenets? And how much of Liberal ideology should the party give up for the end game of winning, of staying in power? This is how I see it. There are two waves of thinking shaping our country at the moment. On the one hand, fiscal profligacy is the order of the day. No matter how big the deficit, there is no appetite for spending restraint. And on the other, you have a rising tide of what could broadly be called social conservatism. This manifests itself in populism, nationalism, and protectionism. Both forces are shaping the government's policies and shaping the government's budget. It's said that voters get the government they deserve. Well, in this case, they've got the budget they deserve. This brings us to the mood in Australia at the moment, which is about embracing a social conservatism at home while putting up walls to the forces of globalisation abroad. A growing sense that we are all either haves or have-nots is infecting our politics at every level, even the budget. This means a lurch towards nationalism, occurring at this most globalised moment in world history. It reflects itself in many ways. The popularity of welfare drug testing stories that Mark mentioned before. There's concern about immigration levels, and not just about refugees, but about legitimate migrants, increasingly blamed for high house prices and congestion in our suburbs. Thus, even skilled workers are in the frame with the abolition of the 457 visa program, a program that has allowed Australia's startup community to not only thrive but exist. Businesses from restaurants who are bringing in qualified chefs to startups relying on programmers from overseas are tearing their hair out over the reforms. There's protectionism. There's always been a protectionist edge to Australia, one of the so-called five pillars of the Australian settlement. And it was only relatively recently that this began to be unwound in earnest. But an increasing number of voices in both major and minor parties are asking whether free trade is all it's cracked up to be. They're emphasising a suspicion that the benefits of free trade are unevenly spread. Ironically, it was Labor in the 1980s which began the process of unwinding protectionism that is now sounding the alarm bells most loudly. And recall Bill Shorten's widely panned television commercial talking about employing Australians first. The divide, this conflict between the haves and the have-nots, has intensified. And lest one nation pick up steam by focusing on the regions, the government has had to accommodate this sentiment. Trump seized on this Rust Belt mood successfully, and Hanson is having some success. But the fact that she's not having more is more of a reflection on her own personal political failings, not the fact that people in the regions aren't feeling marginalised. The disconnect between the inner city world and the suburbs and the regions is strong. And in the suburbs, where people have big ambitions for their children, they're concerned that their tax dollars are being wasted, rotted by people on welfare. Times are truly tough. Which brings me to the second attitude prevailing in Australia, which is leading to fiscal profligacy and economic bloating that's shaping our country and has influenced the federal budget. I don't know how many of you have read Mia Friedman's new book, Work, Strife, Balance. Probably not many, but I have. In it, she wrote about how there's a new trend where women who are successful are often not liked, and to be liked, you have to expose your flaws and your vulnerabilities. And true to form, she's spoken about the marriage difficulties that she had early on, her anxiety issues, and her body image issues, and she even posts on social media pictures of what she calls her confronting stomach. And she rarely talks about her incredible achievements and the fact that her company, Mamma Mia, has gone global. This sentiment that Mia's tuned into among women and mothers groups is actually a national phenomenon. It's not a female thing. Success is not celebrated. Aspiration has been replaced by derision. In Australia today, there's a growing animosity towards the successful and the wealthy. Voters hold on to a view that if you've accumulated wealth, you've somehow cheated the system and should share your wealth with the rest of Australia. Economic redistribution has, of course, long been a Labor tenet, and tall poppy syndrome is a common characteristic in Australia. But these notions have been cultivated by our political leaders on both sides and allowed to flourish. The attitude strongly shapes policy and certainly politics. Those who work hard are punished by income and company tax rates that are among the highest in the world, It's a point that even Paul Keating made last week when he was astounded by Bill Shorten's demand that the temporary deficit tax levy of 2% be kept on those earning over $180,000, along with the Medicare levy increase, which would have taken the top marginal tax rate to 49.5%. As Keating said, that's the state confiscating almost half of people's income. And think of the tone, for anyone who did watch Bill Shorten's reply speech, think of the tone with which he spoke about millionaires in his speech. It was with the same disgust as if they were criminals, not people who may be contributing greatly to our country. And that's how low Australia has sunk, that it's popular for a politician to denigrate those who dare to succeed and dare to save. This populism brings with it the real concern that Australia will become a country of massive mediocrity rather than attracting world leaders in science, technology, startups, or medicine. If business leaders and wealth generators and some of the world's most brilliant minds, if they've chosen to live in Australia, it's not because of our tax policy. It's because of our beaches, our climate, our lifestyle, our safety and security. Even today, when Twiggy gave away $400 million, an ABC broadcaster said he should have kept his donation secret. We're oblivious, seemingly oblivious, to the fact that we're at risk of becoming an unproductive country, defined by a population who have a sense of entitlement. Work-life balance is seen as a right. Welfare is seen as a right, even for those who are not among our community's most vulnerable. Ironically, for all the social conservatism I mentioned earlier, we are economically turning increasingly socialist. The budget papers, if you read them, show that our revenue this year is $444 billion. Our expenses are $464 billion. Our social security and welfare spend is around a third of that at $164 billion. And it makes up more, that welfare spend makes up more than the spend on defence, health and education combined. Australians don't seem to think that they should pay in full for their doctor's bills, their medicine, their education, their transport, even if they can afford to. They even now seemingly think, that the government should help them get into the home market if they're first home buyers. The ethos of hard work is slowly being replaced by a sense that employers owe you something. Aussies believe the music should never stop and that they don't need to contribute in any way to community. And the sentiment is only getting worse through the selfie generation and the fickle attitude towards jobs and their inability to save and be frugal and understated. There are now generations, admittedly, including mine and Mark's, who have never experienced economic recession, who have never lived through difficult times. We only know low interest rates, high unemployment, and the benefits of strong economic growth conditions as a result of the mining boom. These generations are unaware of the great threat if the economy is not managed properly. There's a part of the population, a growing part, who live on debt, and therefore they don't see a problem with the government raising its debt ceiling. The attitude is obvious when you speak to Christian Porter or Alan Tudge about the exploding welfare sector, like I have when I've interviewed them in recent weeks. They recently applied a new system that I'm sure you've heard about, a new technology system, to compare people's tax returns with how much they said they earned when they applied for welfare. This would seem sensible. But the uproar was intense. Linda Burney even referred Alan Tudge off to the AFP, seriously, the police, for correcting the erroneous claims being published in the irresponsible Fairfax Press, who were defending those who were frauding the system. And some of them claimed that they'd earned only $5,000 when in fact their salary was up towards the $100,000 mark. Fairfax and Labor were successfully defending the welfare frauds. Some politicians I've spoken to believe this sense of self-entitlement could see Australia on the same trajectory as Europe, only 20 or 30 years behind. The Coalition has learned the hard way that Australians today have little acceptance for spending cuts. They won't accept an argument for belt tightening. As you know, the coalition was forced to abandon its goal of spending restraint or likely face electoral defeat. They argue they had little else to do but raise taxes, a proposition that goes against the very core of economic conservatives. So in my view, the government's policies and its federal budget represents this dual wave of thinking that's shaping Australia right now, or this dual mood. Economic hardheads in the party are truly despairing over the fact that debt is not being tackled more aggressively in the budget. And critics have argued that if the coalition gives in to Labor and adopts all their policies, what's the actual point of being in power? The question is, are the days of spending restraint truly over? Will any political party or leader have the strength, the numbers, or such an overwhelming mandate that they can make tough decisions and claw back spending? Ministers I've spoken to ask how they can honestly front up to their electorate and tell them that the coalition is still a party of small government and lower taxes, when their policy settings at the moment are the precise opposite. Ministers are pondering deep questions about whether they'd rather stay in government, unable to implement their true agenda, or lose government filled with conviction that they stay true to what they believe in. The battle the government is having is not whether their budget has been ill-considered. The poll results show that it has been popular with most voters. The battle the government's having is with people on the right of economics who would rather a pure form of liberal economic management. But the truth is, the Treasurer has been left with no other real option. You can't underestimate the importance for Turnbull, whatever he says publicly, of improving his results in News Poll, given he used them as a platform for overthrowing Abbott. Fearful of not winning the next election, the Turnbull government has handed down a budget the electorate wants. The government also needed to pacify Shorten, who was claiming to own the fairness ground, in a repeat of the, you know, unfair and mean and tricky messaging of Labor's from the early 2000s. The Liberal Party actually undertook $250,000 of Crosby Textor research prior to the budget to ensure that it was aligned with what Australians expect of their government. And you'd have to wonder what responsibility political leaders have between pandering to what the electorate wants or helping them move towards a new way of thinking. Should leaders try to change a society to convince them of the need for budget repair? And Joe Hockey tried, and whether it was that he gave his speech, Age of Entitlement speech overseas, or whether it's that he dropped it to the little red Fairfax Press, either way, his message was not able to be communicated. His message was lost. Australians are less concerned about big government and debt, and yet the government is being judged on trying to balance the budget. It's a tough situation to be in. The question of whether this year's budget has been a success will be measured on two fronts. Firstly, its reception among Australians, including a News Poll. And secondly, whether it is passed, and this is the most crucial one. The measure of success of this budget has to be whether it passes the Senate. Otherwise, there's little point in a budget at all. It's simply a fantasy document that exists for Turnbull and Morrison's own personal interest. Whether it passes is yet to be determined, but it's looking promising for the government. While the budget does raise concerns over what the coalition stands for, the fact of the matter is, at another dinner in Canberra tonight, where the party's praising Menzies, Menzies was pragmatic. And if you want to be successful in politics, the lesson to take from him, I think, is that you have to be pragmatic. When you fail in politics is when you go too far, like John Howard did with work choices. The key to successful government, whatever party you're in, is to take the people with you, but not to get too far ahead of the population. Politicians can try to coerce the public to accept a position, but they can't jump ahead of them entirely, or they will lose them. It's a lesson Turnbull has learned and can be seen in spades in the 2017 federal budget. Thank you.
Now, without a microphone, come over here, Mark. This is the way we do it here. It's awfully cozy. You'll have questions from the audience. Yeah. We haven't got a roving mic because it seems to have all collapsed. We'll find out about why tomorrow. You won't know about that. I'll take questions from the floor and we'll see if we can get through all this. You two will just have to stand there and offer your opinions. I just want to start off by, it was fascinating how you took two different approaches. You took a more traditional one, you went the other way. But the thing that came through both of them was that it's what Jeffrey Blaney said just the other day in one of the programs. It's really democracy at work. And some people around the world are thinking democracy's in a very fragile state at the moment. So what would you do if you had to run the country and make this budget work? Tell us a bit about how a leader could communicate with the sort of knowledge you have of the electorate's mood and whatever. Each of you have a go. Tell us how you'd make it work with the people's mood at the moment.
Well, I think it's clear that that the government or our political system is in crisis mode. And I think I agree when I speak to Tony Abbott about the need for Senate reform. You know, it seems ludicrous that you have a situation where you win government, you're prime minister, and you cannot implement your own agenda. It's the entire system is broken. So basically, you get the budget that Jackie Lambie will agree to, that Nick Xenophon will agree to, that Pauline Hanson will agree to. You know, in effect, they are the true people. Nick Xenophon, who has more power in this country than him? You could argue he even has more power at the moment than Scott Morrison. So I would have to agree with Abbott that there needs to be serious reform of the political system, starting with the Senate.
I think if you look at, say... Oh, I should get more crazy. I think interesting, right? So you look at the other liberal democracies around the world at the moment. You've got the US, where President Trump has made it very clear that he wants to tear down some of the institutions that we've known for so long. And I don't know about you guys, but I look at my phone or turn on the TV every morning aghast at what's the next bit of news to come out of the US. And you've got Europe, which is on the verge of collapse, but maybe with Macron's election a couple of weeks ago, it could have put that off for a bit longer. But I think it's interesting also with, say, you've got, I think, two very traditional Tory leaders right now with Malcolm Turnbull and Theresa May. And I think that the two of them are very cut from the same cloth. They're very much conservatives who don't want to rock the boat, who are not there for radical change, but they do want to make some changes around the edges. I think the one thing that Malcolm Turnbull can learn from Donald Trump, and I know that's a very strange, terrible thing to even think about, but what I think Malcolm Turnbull lost, really did lose the populist edge that he had before becoming Prime Minister. One of the reasons why so many people in the party loved him over Abbott was that he really did speak for a more sort of sensible central idea of where people were in this country. And I think that what Malcolm Turnbull could do, and this is my bit of advice that I've said behind the scenes to people who are in the PMO, I think he could tweet more. I think that he could be a little more loose. No, I really do think this. I think Malcolm Turnbull, what he needs to do is remember that we're not all buying newspapers and we're not all listening to 2GB or we're not all watching Sky News. And the problem being is I am completely on board with making sure that that we all have very, great media diets through those institutions. What Malcolm Turnbull needs to remember is that he was an amazing connector on things like Q&A, Sunrise, The Project. He was great at Twitter originally, and he's really stepped way back from that, and he's put up all of these walls. And I think that's one thing he probably could do. I think that Malcolm Turnbull needs to put down the walls and be a little bit more open.
But most Australians aren't on Twitter, are they?
No. But what happens on Twitter is that people like you and I and other journalists are constantly on the lookout for new bits of information or new news. What Malcolm Turnbull could do is if Bill Shorten did an interview on 2GB or whatever, he could live tweet it. And we would all be, oh my God, look what Malcolm Turnbull's doing. Like what Trump does. Trump is schooling the media in the US at the moment. Probably not in the last couple of weeks, but before that. He found a way to hijack the news cycle. And I think that Malcolm Turnbull has forgotten how to win at the news cycle.
Yeah, good point. All right, let's
hand down
the back.
Thank you. I'd like to just refer to a recent study which has come out of Berkeley, California, on the proposed corporate tax reductions in America. And it's a fairly scathing report because it was going to bring the tax rate down from about 35% to 15%. But with deductions and credits, it was going to come down to about 27% anyway. The thing is, it was going to cost America about $2 trillion over 10 years. It was going to bring... It was going to cause companies not to invest, but rather to buy stock in other companies, and it was going to cause a great deal of problems in terms of the budget and in terms of the budget deficit.
Your question?
I would like you to try and explain how the Australian proposal to reduce taxes does not fit into this picture.
Can I just say on that, look, I'm not an economist. I'm not going to pretend like I'm going to stand up here and explain why it couldn't work here in this country. I would just say that the thing that I talk to, whether it's ministers in the cabinet room or if it's people in the street or if it's my family and friends, is that there really is an appetite out there of rage towards, and this is what Shari touched on, rage towards elites and rage towards those in business who do have... who are turning over immense amounts of profit. So we've seen that obviously in the banking tax the last couple of weeks. So I'll just say that with wage growth at, was it 1.8%, 1.7% in the private sector, I think that if the government were to embark on a really aggressive company tax cut journey, I think that they would have their fingers burnt because people who are the workers are not feeling the profits of that. And in saying that, when Malcolm Turnbull spoke to Macron in France 2 weeks ago, he spoke about company tax rates. So I wouldn't put it past Malcolm Turnbull to do something about this in the next couple of years, but I would just suggest that when it comes to an aggressive pull down of that rate to, say, you know, the teens, I think that we're well off that just because, again, we have... workers in this country who are not feeling any type of benefit when that happens.
Do you want me to answer that as well, or should we move on to the next question?
Do you want to make a response?
I just think it's incredibly important to lower the company tax rate. I mean, we can't have ours, you know, among the highest in the world when Trump is moving to lower his, when the UK has done so, when already a lot of our companies are moving overseas, you know, to places like Singapore. We're losing business. That means that, you know, fewer people are being employed. So I think Scott Morrison's argument is very powerful and very strong that we need to lower the tax rate so that businesses can hire more people and pay them better. And salary growth has been stagnant for the past 5 years or so. And so unless we make it a bit easier for companies to operate in Australia, they will continue to go overseas and that trend will accelerate and it'll be very problematic for us.
Yeah. Norman, I'd like your comment. Since the Liberal government got in, they have never taken the people with them. They have never taken the opposition with them. Two examples. We all read about Xenophone floating around America and how he was going to start a party. I understand that Turnbull never, ever called him up on the phone.
Is it Bernardi?
Bernardi, right?
Yeah.
Brought him in and said, let's sit down and have a talk. 2 days ago, I've been listening on the radio today, that Darren Hinch has not even seen the budget. I mean, he's a senator, and he went on Sky News and actually said that he has not seen the budget yet. They have not even discussed it with any of the senators. So I'm quite sick and tired of listening to the Liberal Party telling me about the Senate.
Is there a
question,
Norma?
Because they don't talk to them.
Got a question, Norma?
Nope. I want your comment about this. I mean,
well, can I just say, yeah.
Sorry,
I mean, that was probably the best thing that could be said.
Sorry,
no, compared to, like, well, from what I was told anyway, from what I've spoken to people about down in Canberra, is that the current regime under Matthias Cormann in the Senate is exponentially better than what Eric Abetz and his band of Senate leaders were like under Abbott. They are much better at negotiating with the crossbench. They're much better at keeping people along for the ride. But I think that when it comes to, say, the Bernardi example, the government thought to themselves, like, they did act late, but in many ways it was not as crucial as what they really thought, because they didn't think that they were going to be losing someone who was going to whip up a whole bunch of other conservative senators to join the side. So, look, I would only just say that compared to the previous leadership group, this leadership group is much better at dealing with the Senate.
I think the Bernardi thing, though, is a really good point, because the fact that he was looking at defecting was front page of The Australian around Christmas time. Bernardi, to maximise publicity and to maximise pain for the government, waited till the first day of Parliament in February this year to actually defect. And he did, you're right, he did not have one call, nothing from the government. His friend Eric Abetz reached out to him, I think via text message, the day before. The day before Parliament returned. You know, it was far too late. So, yeah, there should have been definitely a concerted effort to bring him in. The problem is, of course, he and Turnbull strongly dislike each other. So probably Malcolm wouldn't have minded him getting out of the Parliament. But it did prove to be difficult, especially with the extradition treaty.
Only ever to portfolio, which is another serious problem.
Mm. Although, yeah,
it would have...
Yeah.
He wouldn't have been running around the countryside making statements.
If he was in cabinet.
Yes.
I think maybe instead of speaking to Abbott about Senate reform, you ought to speak to the Senate about Abbott reform. but there's a problem, and everybody recognizes Bill Shorten learned very well from Abbott. And basically he's pushing that thing, and that's a very hard line to stop. So if the Liberal Party was really interested in getting the reform through, they ought to work out who is going to lose. My generation's just fine. You're the generation who's going to have to pay off that Greek thing. Now, a part of your generation, of course, is a lot of left idealism. I myself was that way. And the problem is getting these people to say, hang on, you are the people who are going to wind up like Greece. And if the Liberal Party really began hammering what does happen to Greece when this happened, they didn't do that. If they hit that very, very hard, there'll be millennials saying, my God, maybe
okay,
he's right.
You got a question?
That was a question. Can you comment on that?
I think that's a great point. Really good point. And possibly they haven't terrified us enough, and instead they've chosen, at least in the lead up to this budget, they chose the complete opposite strategy of trying to boost morale and boost confidence and tell everyone that better times are ahead. And, you know, there's a surplus come 2021. But possibly they, you know, a leader who is a very strong communicator could argue that point and tell the younger generations, you know, what's at stake.
There's a real generational war on the cusp, and if we're not already in it, I'm probably in the wrong audience here to say, but one of the biggest things for me is we are going to be the ones that are paying for climate change, like, decades from now. But beside the climate change thing, which I know will divide people...
Paying for it in terms of attacks or in terms of the hot weather?
In terms of the, savage environmental impacts.
Okay.
So all of those houses on the cliffs that are going to fall into the water. So, but what I will say is this, is that on things like intergenerational difference, when it comes to... my generation is acutely aware that the boomers didn't pay for... Well, a lot of them didn't pay for university, and we are the ones that are coming out with $50,000 degrees. We are acutely aware of how... Yeah, that was Whitlam's fault. But a lot of people benefited, and we aren't. And the other one... and this is one that, bizarrely, traffics really well online because people are angry about it. Young people is negative gearing. One of the reasons why young people are so angry is that they're going to auctions on the weekend, and they're seeing someone bid against them who has adding a sixth property to their portfolio, and there are first home buyers who can't get into the market. And I'm not suggesting that the government owes you a house or whatever. I'm just suggesting that generational thing you're talking about is very real, and it's very vicious.
Okay, down the back there. Tom first, yeah. And then down the back.
Tony Abbott, especially in The Australian, and he has a big article, is saying that the current budget is definitely a leftist budget. What do you think about it?
Well, I don't think... I think that on some of the big stuff... I'm sort of with Albanese, which he came out a couple of days ago to said this. In many ways, Labor has won the policy argument on a few things, especially Medicare. The fact that they set up a Medicare fund to continue funding it on the NDIS, the arguments, the policies, that's it now. There's no bipartisan disagreement. So on NDIS and Medicare, we've got broad agreement in this country that we want those two things preserved. And so I think it's interesting when Tony Abbott is coming out and saying this is a leftist budget. I think it's very much to the left of him. I don't know. I don't know if it's leftist per se.
On the question of budget repair and inverted commas and deficits in the future and the like, do you think that in terms of selling to the public in general, the notion of reducing expenditure by the government sector, it would be advantageous if some business enterprises of note did in fact relocate abroad? Because without that, it seems that the debate is effectively entirely in the abstract, and that to sell such a notion politically to a majority of the electorate would require more than just abstract assertion.
It's a question about whether the idea of businesses going offshore is still only in the abstract, and whether this is where the message falls flat.
I think when you speak to, and I can't name them now, but there are, you know, maybe there should have been a more concerted effort to tell Australians about the businesses that have already left Australia and the business leaders who are having more success overseas. I mean, when I was in New York recently, I had a chat to Anthony Pratt, and he said, he made the point that America has become the best place in the world for manufacturing, and he's taken a lot of his business to the United States, and he still has a large portion of it here in Australia. But there are so many businesses who are just finding the environment here, and not just the company tax rate, but also a lot of other regulations and reg tape, they're finding it too difficult to operate here, and so they are moving overseas.
I think Sherry touched on this in her speech, which, like, one of the reasons, I spoke to a banker a couple of weeks ago, one of the reasons why British bankers come here is the lifestyle. Like, it's so good living in Sydney. It's so good living in Australia. And that's the reason why they apply for transfers. I think one of the companies recently was BHP, right? Like, BHP were threatening to move if they didn't get some of the way with the government. I would just say that when it comes to the communication, trying to communicate with the public about this sort of stuff, they need to talk about real jobs in real areas. Like, they need to talk about rural areas, regional areas, young people. And I think the worst part about it is that for many upper middle class or middle class young people, they're always going to be okay in a developed economy like Australia. It's the lower end. We've lost manufacturing jobs in this country, and we've lost a whole, essentially, sector of low-wage jobs for young people who didn't need to go to university or go to TAFE. They could actually go to work on the shop floor. So I think that's really worrying, and I think that if you're going to communicate it, I think you need to communicate it in very real terms and in real areas as well.
Mm. Over the back, last question.
More journalists, when reporting the news, throw in their opinions rather than being factual and giving a balanced approach. Do you see that hurting journalism?
Yes.
In the trade? For
yes.
For example, Mark, I can tell that you have a disdain for Trump. Should I be reading that when...
I don't have a... So here's
just
interesting...
The for them.
Oh, okay, I'll repeat the question. So you're talking about journalists who imbue their reporting with opinion, right?
Correct.
Okay. So what social media has done is given reporters and journalists a constant broadcasting service of many things that probably would never have got past a sub-editor, right? And I see it all the time. On the left and on the right. Some of the things that left-wing commentators and right-wing commentators say on Twitter is just outrageous and disgusting. I agree with you that our generation of reporters have been sucked into that, and we are trying, or I'm trying very hard to make sure we stand impartial. But I also think that the one thing you can do as a journalist is to maintain your credibility is to call BS when you see it. Like, I don't need to pretend that the current... you know, crisis or chaos around Donald Trump isn't happening. Like, I think that that's silly. Like, I think that it's, yeah, to say it's fake news is also wrong. Like, it's real. Like, this is happening. There's a special prosecutor that's been hired to look into it. So I think I agree with you, and I think it's a really good thing, and I would tell young journalists all the time to stay off Twitter when it comes to their opinions as much as possible. But the other thing that our generation has developed is also a very strong BS detector, is knowing when they're being lied to. Mm-hmm. And so I think that especially the political ease, that, you know, that sort of that droning thing that people like Matthias Cormann might get into. That it's like, oh my God, you haven't said anything for 30 seconds. I think that that is on its way out as well because of the modern media environment.
Yeah, I think it's very dangerous that more and more journalists are expressing their views and you have less straight, objective reporting. And this is most problematic with the ABC. You know, it's taxpayer-funded and we expect straight, balanced reporting, but they focus on certain issues, progressive issues, rather than, you know, many other issues that are worth investigation. And journalists, you know, particularly at Fairfax as well. The Sydney Morning Herald was once one of the great newspapers in Sydney. It and The Age, and to the Age to a much greater extent, they're left-wing papers. There's no getting around it. And the journalists they employ, most journalists are probably left-leaning anyway, but the journalists they employ express on social media, even very senior ones, you know, editors, kind of outrageous partial views that... I started in journalism when I was like 18, and so I don't know if I should admit this, but I've never voted so that I would stay objective, so I would never have to go through the process of thinking which party I would support, particularly because I got into politics, reporting on politics at such a young age. That's the model I think we should have, that we are truly objective and we don't take sides. And that's being lost increasingly. And you only have to look at journalists like Paul Bongiorno and Twitter to see what they really think. And that's why social media has exposed this, because you can see what the journalists think. So how can you trust their reporting? You can't.
It happens on the right as well.
I'm afraid we're going to have to call it quits there. Well, a really quick one.
Good one. I mean, Mark, you made the point before about, I think it was like the volume of activity on social media and Twitter, whatever. And then you use the phrase, sort of, this is the main game or the mainstream news, whereas the topics sort of mentioned, I would look at that and suggest a lot of it's sort of just noise and like who really cares about Jackie Lambie talking about this topic?
Okay,
so I agree with you.
So is it mainstream?
No, I think, I know this is going to sound really harsh, I think you're out of touch. Like, I know that's going to sound really bad, right? So it's like, if you watch The Project, or watch Sunrise, or watch The Today Show, which are very in touch with their audiences, know their audiences better than anyone, they ran that drug testing story very high. Like, and they were running Jackie Lambie live interviews because they knew that this was the thing that was cutting through. So I think that that's the problem is that, like, I agree, the most newsworthy thing is the banking tax. Like, that's no doubt. I agree with you. But it's not the thing that people are reading and sharing and talking about. It's not to say that it's not newsworthy. It's the most newsworthy thing. But it's always interesting to remember that there's a water cooler topic that people are talking about outside of the chamber that we should always remember. That if you don't engage with it, that's why I think the government was genius with this drug trial. I think it was genius because it sent off everyone chasing in this one area. I just think that sometimes we forget that we are always... I mean, probably Sherry Markson has the best tabloid nose for journalism in the country, I think that we need to remember that tabloid journalism, tabloid news, is really important in the way you sell and develop budgets.
Okay, well, we'll call it quits here. I reckon we've had a buzz tonight. This has been a fabulous presentation. Thank you both. They'll be on APAC. We'll let you know the times when the broadcasts are repeated. And, of course, we'll have papers in the Sydney Institute, Sydney papers. So thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone, for coming.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.